Thank you. It's good to be back here again. So yes, like I say, every Quantum Foundations conference needs a crackpot, and I got ample evidence of that. Like, I'm a quantum linguist or something like that. I mean, quantum mechanical words. I mean, figure out what it means. I mean, I didn't pick these words. These places pick these words, but I think it officially makes me a crackpot, please. But that's good. I mean, there's sort of boxes you need to tick in your life, and being a crackpot is one of them. Okay, wires and boxes. So, I mean, I've been talking about these things for now 15 years, so I'm just going to keep this bit brief. The basic idea is this is the only way I just do signs anymore. Like, I just fed up with all these symbols and algebra and all these things. So I work with things like that now. Like, I mean, it's clear what this means. This is a beam splitter. You've got photons coming in, you've got photons coming out. So the way we think about such a picture is we think about a box as a process, any kind of process, and we think of a wire as a system, any kind of system. It can be anything.
There is a beam splitter which has two inputs and one out?
I guess so. You can do whatever you want. I mean, this is another example. Like, I mean, here you don't think of physical systems anymore, but you got a program, you got like an input which is lists, outputs which is lists. Can be very different too. Like, this is like basically the entire English cuisine in one picture. So it's not just about physics, this stuff. It's not just about science. It can be about like cuisine too. Or, I mean, there's another example of a process. So it's quite universal as a formalism to apply to a lot of different situations. And then the sort of mathematical content, like, for example, if you've got a group or a vector space, you've got some operations like adding stuff, multiplying stuff with a number. And the sort of basic operations you got here is that you can plug stuff together. It's the same idea. It's the same idea of like multiplying two elements in a group or something like that. So you plug stuff together. That's sort of the compositional structure. I mean, for people who know category theory, this is category theory. These are monoidal categories. That's really what it is. But this is much nicer. This is much nicer. You don't win anything by saying it's category theory. You lose. You just lose. You don't win. I mean, yeah, we saw category theory talk earlier. I'm talking pretty much about the same stuff. Like, but
are you tired of winning?
What? Right. Okay. So, it's important. The important thing is what can you compose with what? Like you don't want to do this. Because then I mean, you lose your computer. Right? I mean, I wouldn't want to clean it after. There you go. So that's the sort of thing you can't do. Now, to find some more recognizable things in this sort of language, whenever we see something without an input, which I depict with this triangle, we think of it as a state. It's a thing you have, and then you can act upon it. Somebody gives it to you. You don't really care how it came there. You just get the description of the state. The state doesn't have a description of its past coming with it. A test, or what people would call an effect, is like you've got an input but no output, and a number is a thing without an input and an output. And this very much resembles something everybody knows, because it's really like Dirac notation. If you take one of these triangles, you rotate them a bit and you chop the corners off, you get like a cat. If you take that one, you get a bra, and if you compose them, you get a bracket. So the idea of having an input product is building in these pictures, and the idea of a Born rule is building in these pictures. This is just a Born rule. You can really think of when a state meets a test, what the number it sort of becomes is the probability of getting a positive answer in that test for that state. So it is very familiar. So these pictures are actually a two-dimensional extension of Dirac notation, but it doesn't come with the Hilbert space connotation per se. But essentially, as a notation, it's two-dimensional Dirac notation. The second dimension, what is the second dimension? This is really important. Let me go to something like this. The second dimension really means, let me take another picture, that we can write two wires side by side, which is not something you can do in Dirac notation because it's one-dimensional. And this really means I'm dealing with a composite system. This is just putting two wires side by side is a composite system. Now, since what is the connection with quantum logic? Well, in quantum logic, I was never able to put two wires side by side, like old-fashioned quantum logic. Here, putting two things side by side is basically the primitive of the language, the thing you start with before you say anything else. And then the question is, can we in some way articulate that putting two wires side by side are like putting two cups side by side or putting two electrons side by side, because these are different things. They're going to behave differently if you do that. And so basically, this is structured to reason about composite systems, both sequential composition and parallel composition. That's really what this formalism is about, nothing else. Okay? Now, like I just said, we want to say something about quantum systems versus whatever. I don't like the word classical, for reasons you will understand by the end of this talk. Quantum systems, as in defining quantum theory, versus something else. And we go back to 1935, which is also the time where old-fashioned quantum logic was born, a la von Neumann, literally, because he started this thing with Birkhoff. And for most of the past century, when people associated logic with quantum physics, it was this Birkhoff-Neumann quantum-type logic, or Piron, or Fowlis, Rendel. It was all sort of in the same spirit. But at the same time, Schrödinger had a bit of a different idea. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but he sort of said that but the characteristic of quantum physics is what happens if you put two things together. Just put two things together, and the way it sort of behaves differently than it behaves classically, that's really the characterization of quantum theory. And nobody really picked this up at the time. Nobody picked this up. And if you would do sort of, let's do a von Neumann on quantum mechanics, it really means you abstract everything away except the thing you care about, which in the case of von Neumann gave him like a propositional structure, which was called the quantum logic. Like if you do the same here, you strip everything away from quantum mechanics except what Schrödinger said we should care about, you actually get pictures. That's really, so the diagrams and the wires putting things side by side, that's really sort of an articulation of this idea. Let's take this as the most primitive structure of a theory, like the way we compose systems. And these diagrams, which allow you to put two wires side by side, they exactly do that. Right. So now, here is the thing. We want to have quantum mechanics. We don't want to have any sort of, we don't want to have a cookbook. We don't want a cookbook. We want a theory of quantum mechanics. So what is the way you actually articulate, in the most basic sense, the fact that you're dealing with systems that, when you put them together, they don't behave like individuals anymore, but you get phenomena like entanglement and stuff like that coming up. Basically, the way you do this is by making your diagrams a little bit more liberal. How do I make them liberal? Well, I don't really care anymore what an input and an output is, and so I'm allowed to actually connect two inputs to each other. I'm allowed to actually feed an output back in the past and treat it as an input in the future, or I can even connect two outputs together. So it's sort of a liberal notion of diagram, but essentially, I mean, you can give algebraic content to it. Essentially, what you do is you introduce a special state, which is represented by this little cup-shaped wire here. And that's what you think of as like a Bell state or something like that. That's like a Bell state. And surprisingly enough, interpreting these as like very liberal wires, which you can sort of connect past to past, and gives you enough structure to start deriving stuff of quantum mechanics. Gives you enough structure. You don't need anything more. I mean, to some stuff, not all the stuff, some stuff. Let me show this. So this equation we saw in Dominic Stark, right? We saw this idea of like yanking a wire. And this is really the equational context of saying that you liberalize your diagrams. It's the same thing. So this is sort of an algebraic way of saying we are very liberal with our diagrams here. I stick to this sort of, because there is no equations here. This is a theory you can reason with, but which has no equations. Of course it has equations, because basically the equation is this stuff as wires and wires behave as wires. That's really the equation. Wires behave like wires. That's really the equational content of it. And you will see, like, we're going to derive quantum teleportation now. It's like a very old thing, of course. You got some state, then you share a Bell state, and then you ask, how are we going to get this state to the other side? I mean, the simple solution is, you stick a piece of wire there. Yeah, since this behaves like a wire, you get that. That's the end of the story. Well, it's not really the end of the story, because you may have some error here, because you can't implement this effect with certainty, and then you get your correction on the other side. Right? That's quantum teleportation. There's nothing more to it. So that's an old story. But I mean, this is a cute language. You can prove some stuff with it, but of course you can't prove everything in quantum mechanics about it with this. This is not enough. You need more. And so then I mean, this was 2003 or 2004. Then 2007, we got these things. So these things we saw in Dominic Stark. You remember he had this sort of fork-type structures and things like that. That's this. That's this. So we introduced that. I'll say something more about this later. We call them spiders, actually, like a bunch of stuff, things with a bunch of inputs and a bunch of output. Then it turned out that we wanted to decorate these spiders. Spiders usually carry nice red decorations, like skulls and stuff like that on their heads, so we wanted to do that too. And then you actually need two colors. You need two colors. And actually, these two colors, they represent complementarity, like position and momentum or something like that. So that's sort of... And then, I mean, if you do this, then you get a universal language with respect to Hilbert space, meaning you can express every matrix which you can express in Hilbert space by means of this sort of structures. And basically what you can do then is you can produce an entire textbook of quantum mechanics just using this language. Quantum mechanics, quantum computing, quantum foundations, it's all in there. It's all in there. Who didn't buy it yet? Well, you don't deserve to have it then. Okay. So anyway, so this is this. So the sort of stuff you find in there, which is a little bit more sophisticated to express than say teleportation, is, for example, this is proof of quantum non-locality. This just one page is proof of quantum non-locality. I can't really explain it, but basically these are like your Mermin scenarios in a Mermin GXC experiment. And when you see these thick wires, you have to think quantum system. When you see the thin wires, you have to think classical system. These dots are exactly the sort of thing you saw the spiders or what you saw in the talk of Dominic. And then this is basically what quantum mechanics predicts. I mean, this is like called this one, and this is what like any variable theory predict, call it zero, and zero is not equal to one. So you get a contradiction, and that basically says that quantum mechanics is non-local. It's just here in this one picture, the whole story. Everything is here. You don't need more. Right. Okay. Now then, that's the thing. You spend three years riding on a thing like that. Finally, it's over. And you say, oh, okay, now we got this thing which contains everything there is to say. And then some horrible thing happens. like just after the book came out, some really important result was proved. And this is sort of a slight deviation from the content of my talk, but since it's new and a lot of people here who actually have been following this stuff wouldn't know about this. So, and this concerns the idea of completeness. What is completeness about? Completeness is about how much can you prove with these pictures. How much can you prove with this picture that, for example, you can prove in linear algebra? And a first result by Selinger from 2008 that says that any equational statement provable but for string diagrams, by string diagrams, I mean these liberal diagrams, nothing more. Anything you can prove there, everything is provable for string diagrams. I mean, is this a sentence? Any equational statement is provable for, if and only if, oh yeah, it is provable for Hilbert space and linear maps. Which says there is nothing more you can prove in Hilbert spaces if you restrict yourself to this language of string diagram. You can prove everything with diagrams that you can prove in Hilbert space. The caveat here is, of course, an equation in this language will be an equation which between two things you can express in that language, and that language is not universal. So then in 2012, Miriam Bakkens came with a stronger result, and there you use all the spiders and all that, and Miriam showed that the same is true if you take sort of the stabilizer restriction of quantum mechanics. This is like the Bloch sphere as you see it in Speck-Stoy theory, which has sort of 6 points. But it's a theory. Like for example, this non-locality proof is in the stabilizer restriction, so it's rich enough to show non-locality and stuff like that. It's rich enough, so it really has already non-locality built in. So this is significant. This is significant. Then. This is total deviation. We have some other calculus, which I'm not going to talk about, which is called ZW calculus. And then Sion of Mai Amar proved actually universal completeness for that other calculus. Doesn't matter. And then here is the disaster. First, these French guys, they actually proved that Clifford plus T also, you can prove any equation in Clifford plus T, which is approximately universal quantum computing. So anyway, that was sort of, We don't have this in the book, because it didn't exist. And this is really important. This is really important, of course. You can do everything you can do in Hilbert space with these pictures, everything. If you restrict yourself to Clifford plus T, no, doesn't even have to be necessary. Everything. That's really, that's sort of a big hit. So this is Amar. This is Kang Feng and Harney. So they proved that anything you can prove in Hilbert space equationally, you can prove with diagrams. So it's a viable substitute for Hilbert space. And then the French guys, Gay-Gam, and they did a little bit better. And then, okay, these guys did a bit better. And then, so, I mean, this is an ongoing story. This is an ongoing story, right? This is an ongoing thing. I mean, I can ask you why it goes on and goes on. And I can explain that. Like, I'm not going to do this here. But I mean, it's a bit sad because I want to be a crackpot, and we were always sort of outsiders from the mainstream. And now with this stuff, we actually get funding from quantum computing companies. Yeah, this is from Facebook from yesterday. Alex Kissinger got funding now from Rigetti, because this becomes like genuine stuff. The thing is, you can actually use automated reasoning, like AI now, to reason about quantum stuff. You can do compiler optimization in an automated manner using this sort of stuff, because you can represent all your quantum circuits in this way. So this is now becoming practical stuff. Okay, something else. Like any age restrictions, because these are pictures, this is for kids, right? So can kids do quantum mechanics with pictures? Any age. So this is actually an experiment in itself, which I have a lot of joy to explain myself. So this is our book, and this is a book by another person. Anybody know? Anybody knows who? Anybody knows who?
Terry.
That's Terry Rudolph, yeah? And he was bragging so much that this book was very suitable for young people. So I did the experiment. I put the two books on the table. That's my daughter, and she picked ours. That's
some chocolate underneath that book.
Right. So now, serious. Okay, are there any age restrictions on proving this thing, on doing this thing? So this is an ongoing thing now. Is that it here? I've written one book. This is the next one. But it's for kids. Like, for now, it's for high school kids. And this is like a full course on quantum mechanics in pictures for high school kids. And the idea is what it says here. We're going to teach kids in high school this stuff. We have a matching tutorial in Hilbert space, which exactly has the same content. This was a horrible thing to write, you can imagine that. But it has exactly the same content. And then we're going to ask exam questions to the high school children and to the universities. We're probably going to take like first year computer science university student at Oxford or something like that, and then see who does the best at the exam. I mean, it's obvious what's going to happen. I mean, I mean, we're still writing this thing. We're almost done. But I already did some sort of pilot in the sense that I had like a 70-year-old in my office for like a week. I said, okay, you have to study this. I gave it. In 6 hours or so, or 5 hours, he had read the whole thing. I was surprised. That's quick. Okay, now try to solve these questions. And these were university exam questions. Solved like 2/3. That's impressive. Okay, so this is a real thing. This is now a real thing. You can teach quantum mechanics to undergraduates using this language. Now, philosophically, since it's a foundations conference, there is a question which is sort of related to like Searle's Chinese rune thing about intelligence. Do the kids understand quantum mechanics when they solve this exercise? I don't know. Oh no, that's a second question. But how many physicists understand quantum mechanics when they're actually doing it? You could argue nobody. Right? You could argue nobody. So there are some questions there, but I mean, yeah, that's a different issue. So anyway, so this is the sort of thing you find in this tutorial. I am a spider. So these spider are like the algebras Dominic was talking about. Well, the commutative version of it. And then he had a bunch of equations, algebraic equations. And this is basically what all these equations mean. That if two spiders meet each other, they fuse together. So this algebra, I mean, algebraists don't like these spiders. Algebraists like things where you got two legs here and one leg on top. Because you take two things, you combine them, you get a new thing. That's algebra. So here, this is much more complicated. You got many things in and many things out. Now, if you think of something like a copying operation, you got one thing out, two things out, or as many things out as you want. So a copying operation is not something which exists in algebra. It's sort of it lives in a more general realm where also this stuff lives. And that, because you do that, you can actually compress all the equations you saw on Dominic's slide in this simple spider fusion. Now, another way, we call these spiders because it's fun and you can make them speak and stuff like that. It's all cute. But ultimately, the way to think about a thing like this is a generalized wire. So what does a wire do? A wire is something which has two ends, which it connects. Right? That's what a wire do. It has two ends and it connects these two ends. Right? And if you string two wires together, you get a big wire. So a wire just connects two things. You have to think about this thing as connecting multiple things. And so if you connect two generalized wires which connect multiple things, you get a new generalized wire which connects multiple things. That's really what this thing says. So in a way, it sort of generalizes the behavior of a wire or a line. Right. And then, I mean, on one of Dominic's slides, you saw a theorem which had something to do with like relating the spiders to bases, orthonormal bases. So that's our funny way to say the same thing. So if you haven't bought this book yet, this is the big one, then you should buy it for the cartoons like this. So what is this? So what is the deep meaning of this cartoon? Deep meaning of this cartoon is, if it behaves like a spider, then it is a spider. And it is not a dodo, and it is not a dodo dressed as a spider. If it behaves like a spider, it is a spider. So what is the formal, What is the formal content of this statement? Formal content is, if you got something like spiders in your Hilbert space, formally in your category of Hilbert spaces and all that, something which has this behavior, anything which has this behavior, has to be what we call a spider derived from a basis. So it's something like, so it's the one with one input and two output would be your coherent copy operation, for example. So these things, this is an alternative characterization of orthonormal basis. It looks nothing like an orthonormal basis, but this theorem tells you that anything which behaves like that in Hilbert space is an orthonormal basis, which is really weird. I mean, it's just a wacko statement if you think about it, but in Dominic's talk, you really saw how he built this up. He started with this basis element and started to build up these algebraic operations, and they are these things. So I mentioned we have two colors of spiders. I mean, they fight, and then if they fight, they shake each other, and then they're harmful. That's it. So this is quantum complementarity. This is basically a characterization of quantum complementarity, or MEBs, MUBs, in the sort of modern sense. Like, I told you each of these correspond to a basis, and if two of these have this behavior, then they are MUBs. MUBs. I mean, here is an example. This is quantum key exchange. This is really the formal content of quantum key exchange, and this is like somebody sends something to something else. The intruder uses the wrong basis to intercept. Legs fall off, so he gets noise. So this is how you reason with the spiders. This is all you have to know about quantum key exchange to understand the problem, right? So that's this sort of thing. Okay, now the crackpot. All of this was this quantum stuff. So you can do quantum algorithms. You can do everything with the spider language. And now suddenly we're going to talk about language, as in natural language, which is a complete change of scenery. So here is the key question, which anybody, you don't need to be a linguist to understand it. So we have dictionaries for words, right? Why don't we have dictionaries for sentences? I mean generic sentences. I don't mean special phrases. I mean like a general sentence. Why don't we look? If you hear a sentence you never hear before, why don't you go to a dictionary and look it up? Because you know what it means anyway. You know what it means, even if you never hear the sentence before, right? Typically, you know what it means. I'm sure I said sentences today which you never heard before. And hopefully, you understood them. Right? So why is this the case? This is the reason. This is something you all do in your head. You see, it looks exactly like our teleportation diagram, a little bit more sophisticated, but this is really what you do in your head. So what's going on here? I'll explain in detail. So the bottom part, which you see, forget about this does and not, but just look at Alice and like and Bob. They're actually meanings. You have to think of these states as the meaning of these words. And if you go to natural language processing, things like what Google and other stuff, they literally use vectors to represent meanings of things. They use vectors. I mean, I can explain you how these vectors come about. It's not that important. So you can think of these things of vectors or maybe descriptions in a dictionary, anything which represents the meaning of a thing. So that's these triangles. And the stuff on top, that's actually grammatical structure. I mean, so everybody has heard about like Chomsky-style grammar and all that. Well, that's sort of it, in a sort of modern version of it. So the sort of the, I mean, I'll explain a bit later how this worked. And then, so you got this interaction between meanings and grammars. And that's what, so that's what happens in our head. We understand the meaning of a word. We have an understanding of grammar. And this grammar mediates how these different meanings of words in a sentence interact to actually produce the meaning of a sentence. And we all know how to do this. We all know how to do this. We all learn how to do this. I mean, Chomsky thought that this is sort of hardwired in human brains, that grammar is something very specific for humans. I don't believe that at all, like, which is something I'm going to elaborate on later. I think an amoeba understands grammar. An amoeba can pass a grammar exam, I'm sure. So it's nothing human. It's well, anyway, I go on. Let's explain this bit first. So here you see a bunch of algebra. So the first thing you see there, like Lambeck's residuate model, that's really Chomsky grammar. That's like Chomsky grammar in a proper mathematical form, which is some partial order with some operation and blah, blah, blah. It's not important what it is. And then this, the main person there who did all of that in the 50s was Lambeck. He was a person who sort of got the maths really right there, inspired by Chomsky's ideas, of course. And then the same Jim Lambeck, in 2000, he sort of changed the algebra a bit. He actually simplified the algebra. He came up with, and he realized that it was much simpler, and he wrote down these equations. I'm not going to really explain them, but actually these equations correspond to these cups and caps in my diagrams. And I'm not going to, I can explain if you want to know that, but they actually really, literally correspond with the cups and the caps. So I'm not going to make the direct derivations from the equations, but I'll show you how this stuff works. So basically how this mathematics of grammar works is that you got a few things which you call sort of basic types. Do I see anything here? Well, it doesn't matter. Like, you see the N there, N is a basic type and means noun. For example, your object and a subject are both of type noun in a sentence. And then S, the S you see there, the letter S is also a basic type sentence. So it's this is not about atomic types, because a sentence in itself is a basic type. And obviously a sentence is a composite thing, but it doesn't matter. It's a basic type. Something which is not a basic type is a transitive verb. Transitive verb has the following shape there. So you got sentence in the middle, and then you got, you see the an N minus one. This is noun minus one on the left, and this actually means I want the noun. I need the noun. So I'm one noun invert on the left. And then you see this N minus one on the right means I need the noun on the right too. So I need the noun on two sides. And so if I then use this algebra, basically I take this transitive verb type, I stick an N on the left, and I stick an N on the right. They cancel out, and I get S. And this means that if I stick a noun and a transitive verb and a noun together, I get something of a type sentence. And so that's how this thing works. That's how they always work. But this version of the algebra is actually much simpler than that version. I'm not going to go into that. But now, here is the thing. And that's where these diagrams come in. So as a mathematician, you would usually do, I scratch this, I scratch that. And it's gone. But the thing is, you have to actually think of this as a dynamic process that these two annihilate each other, like in a Feynman diagram. They annihilate each other, sentence type goes through. And this basic, so this picture represents the process of this noun interacting with this transitive verb, that noun interacting with this transitive verb, and producing the meaning of a sentence. The only thing I need to do is stick meanings in. I stick these meanings in, I treat this thing as a process, as a linear map, and it actually mediates, it actually makes these three vectors, if you want, or whatever it is, interact into the meaning of a sentence. And that's what's happening in your head. That's literally what's happening in your head. That's how you produce the meaning of a sentence from the meaning of the words. This thing didn't exist before, it turned out. NLP, there was no algorithm to turn meaning of words, meaning of sentences. And you know that if you, Google doesn't care about grammatical structure. I mean, it takes account of word order and stuff like that, but it doesn't understand grammatical structure of a sentence. It doesn't, because they didn't have a model to do it. So this was sort of the first algorithm to do that. And then, I mean, not me, but some other people, they did practical experiments against like the NLP engineers, and they outperformed them. Obviously, because they didn't have a model. So they didn't have a good theory about composition, so it was quite easy to outperform them. I mean, this is now already a few years back that this happened. There's actually more stuff. There's more stuff going on here, which is really elegant, and that's... it still doesn't work. Oh, is it still here? Okay. That's from ages ago. These are vectors. These are meaning vectors. Alice, like, and Bob. So what are these things? I mean, these are words like does and not. They're sort of logical words or functional words in language. They're not sort of words you look up in a dictionary as carrying some, or in an empirical, if you want to establish, people, what people do is they try to establish these meaning vectors empirically. There are methods to do that, like from huge corpus of data to assign a meaning to Alice or Bob or like, you can do that. Now, does and not, that would just be noise if you do that. It would just be noise. So the smart thing to do is to actually figure out what they actually mean in a structural way. And it turns out, what does do in English language? What does it do? Nothing. Right? Does it looks a sort of totally void word which does nothing. And you see, the only thing it does is sort of propagating information via plain wires. That's now not is almost nothing, but it negates something. What you see here, I mean, this pie comes from the spiders, but this is actually a negation box. Now look at this picture. What do we get? We get Alice, we follow the wire. Alice goes into like. Bob goes into like, then something comes out. Not. So what this picture is saying is Alice, Bob, like, not. That's the meaning of the sentence. You see, this wiring exactly gives you that. So here is a more complicated example, and now you see these dots showing up. So so basically in quantum mechanics, why did we introduce these dots? These dots we initially introduced, and this also came out in Dominic's stuff, to capture classical information. Because you got to know cloning theorem in quantum mechanics, which is classical data, quantum systems cannot be cloned. Now, the contrapositive of this is classical system can be cloned. So, and you have to think of this as like copying operations here, like that some information gets copied in two ways. And it means that the data is classical. It's sort of a witness of classicality, the ability to copy it. I mean, that's in the quantum case. Now here in the language case, we were trying to figure out what these things were and what they should be so for the sentence to work. We actually figured out that these spiders were the right thing to express, where are they? Relative pronouns. I don't have the word here, but relative pronouns, like who, you use these spiders to express this. We did experiments, it all works, la la la. So that's all good. Right, so here is sort of an example of a computation. I'm actually using density matrices. For now, I'll explain later why. So you got some density matrices representing she. Who is she? Well, she may be Alice, she may be Beth, she may be whoever. So we make a big mix state of who she could be. Hates, well, actually it turns out that Alice hates Bob. And also it turns out that Beth hates Colin, and blah, 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 blah. So that's the meaning of hates. So we sum all these pairs of people who hate each other. Huh? And Bob is Bob. And then you compute this stuff, then you compute this diagram, because this is just linear algebra, then you compute this diagram and you get Alice. So she who hates Bob is Alice. So you compute these things. Now the reason, I mean, it's sort of clear, the reason I'm using density matrices is for the same reason. So what is a density matrix? A density matrix expresses ambiguity about the state. Meaning language is just packed with ambiguity. And for example, a word like queen is clearly all of this. So it's a clear mixed state, right? I mean, I maybe missed something, but that's density matrix of queen, right? Okay. Okay, from language to cognition. So that sort of. So basically, what I showed before. Now it's a bit formal, because if you don't say put some formal stuff on a slide, nobody believes you. So especially now, I use the word algorithm, because that makes it sound like it's real, right? Yeah. So basically, what is the algorithm we have? So this is an algorithm for meaning composition. You perform the grammatical type reduction of a sentence, which I was doing, like this calculation, which I did. And that produces a picture like this. Then we translate this picture as a linear map, and then we apply this linear map to word meanings to get a sentence meaning. That's the algorithm. Now, this is a compositional recipe, and this, as far as I'm concerned, nothing to do with language specifically. The same thing applies to cog means cognition, to the way we compose other concepts than language meaning in our head. Because we don't reason with language. I mean, the fact that we reason so much with language is pure indoctrination of the school system. Because I guess I mean, natural reasoning is not in terms of language. Like there were times that we didn't have language yet and we were able to reason. We were able to reason about composite stuff. So language is just something which came later. I'll give a bit of philosophy of where language came from later. But the main idea is this whole recipe is not specific to language at all. And you can apply it to cognition. And so that's what we went to do. Now, I mean, I didn't know anything about language when we started this. I still don't. And I definitely don't know anything about cognition. I still don't. So we started reading some books. So when we started to do that, Alex Wills, I remember he was sort of part of the reading group for the first or second reading. So we basically were reading the books by this guy, who's a very famous developmental psychologist, who actually was trying to turn some of his ideas in math. So that is, I mean, it's not high fashion. I mean, it's pretty good for somebody like coming from that direction, the math. And so he has these books, and the essential idea of what he has, and this sort of course resonates with people working in Quantum Foundation, is that a lot of concepts are modeled in convex shapes. So you take convex spaces, explain this later with detail, and then you basically model concepts in examples, and I will give some examples. So it's basically all about convex structures. Why are convex structures good? Because they still have linearity. So if you want to go do empirical stuff, you don't need to know any element of your set. You need sort of to know a sufficient number of things, and then you use linearity to expand everything. So for practical purpose, very important to still have something like a linear structure. And the reason that it's convex is typically when you got two concepts, then you can usually mix them together to have sort of an intermediate concept. For most concepts, this is possible. Think about colors, smell, stuff like that. Especially all our senses allow for interpolation of things, just how our senses work. So that was the reason to go convex. So what we did, but again, they had the same problem as the people in natural language processes. They couldn't compose stuff. So what we said is, okay, we're going to compose your stuff. So how do you do that? I mean, we just turn the guy into a category. Turn the guy. And so this category is called convex row. I'll explain what it is. And I think people doing GPTs just forget about everything they've ever done and start working there. So is John here? Okay, yeah, you here? I've told you this a few times. Now it's in public, so you can't escape it anymore. Right. Okay, so let's see. So this is how, for example, this convex set come about. Actually, this is wrong. I'm using a cube because I don't know how to draw it differently, but what you really want is, you think of this as a circle with all the colors. Like you got yellow, red, blue, la la la. You think of this as white, you think of this as black, or the other way around, and then you get a convex shape like this, and all your colors are in here. All your colors are sitting in here. But this is too hard to draw, so I turned it into a cube. But it's the same idea, like you see, so you see you've got these convex shapes. Now, what is a color? What is a color? A color is not a point in there. Color is not a point in there. We don't think in terms of points of these things. We never do as humans. What we think in terms of is subsets, regions. So there are certain regions which we would, for example, identify as yellow here. That region we probably think of as yellow. That region we probably think of as green, sort of. And this is totally conventional and cultural dependent because, for example, the Greeks had no concept of blue. They didn't have blue. They called the sea green, the Greek sea. If you read all the old Greek texts, the sea is green. It's not blue. So the sea changed color. It didn't do that. It's just like they didn't have a concept of blue. They sort of took different subsets than we take now. That's just it. So, and if you go to different cultures, like the people identify different stuff as color. Like the Eskimos have a lot of whites. They have a lot of whites. Like we just have one white. They have a lot of whites. They don't have many other colors, I guess. Everything is white. Anyway, I mean, it's so good. Like, this is also, of course, wrong, right? Does everybody know why this is wrong? Huh? Yeah, you need five. You need five. I can't draw this. I can't draw a simplex with five corners. So I just took only four. So again, tastes are things which are subsets of these things. Not elements, but it's more subsets. Huh? So these are these convex structures. Now, if you want to say what is a banana, then we need both of these things, right? Because a banana has a taste and a banana has a color and it has a texture too. So you need to get a compositional structure. So, okay, here is my bit of horrible math. Doesn't matter, but I mean, I'm defining a category here, which is a compact closed category of what is called convex relations. So that's the category we work with formally. I'll just tell you in word what's happening here. What's happening here is you got the notion of mixing. So your objects in your category are stuff which allows mixing. This is actually more general than your usually convex structure. Your usual convex structures are part of this, but it's a bit more general. You got, for example, family tree structures here. Because a family tree, if you take like two, you mix them a bit and you get offspring, right? So that notion of mixing is in there too, which is a bit more abstract than your standard convex mixing. And this is the important bit. So basically, your maps are just relations, but they respect the convex structure in some way. They respect the convex structure. And you get what is a compact closed category, which some people know here what it's about, exactly like rel. So a lot of the structure is exactly like in the category of relations. So you get your non-Cartesian product. Those people who know what I mean there, they know what I mean. I mean, that's topology, right? So it's a funny thing, but like Cartesian is a term in category theory, and the Cartesian product, if you look at it in the category of relations, is actually not Cartesian. Sort of a funny thing. Because it behaves like a tensor product. Like the Cartesian product for relations is like a tensor product for linear maps. So it's sort of a very confusing thing. But so this is the compositional structure. The compositional structure is very much like in quantum mechanics. And so basically what you got here is a category of convex spaces which comes with a canonical composition operation, which is exactly like in quantum mechanics, in spirit. But that's why I'm saying GPT people should look at this. The cups are exactly like in rel. You've got these spiders, they're exactly like we know them in rel. So it's an easy category to work with intuitively because we understand it very well. So what you can do now is you can start to combine the color of a banana with the possible taste of a banana and the possible textures of a banana. The apple, color, beer. Is this right?
Well, no, that's very restrictive for beers. I'm sorry, I don't know what you've been drinking.
Okay, that's good. Well, I'm Belgian, man. I have some authority here, you know?
Yes, you do.
Okay. No, but it's wrong for different reasons. Does anybody realize why this is wrong? I mean, nobody here understands his own field. That's obvious. Well, this is totally wrong. I mean, this is totally wrong. What you would write down is something like this. You can't read. Usa told me yesterday they couldn't read it. Yeah. I mean, basically, a banana, it can be green, bitter, and hard, or it can be yellow, sweet, and soft. But it can't be yellow and hard. Can't be, because these things go together, right? So clearly, this was totally wrong. The idea that you would just describe the whole by describing the parts doesn't work here at all. No, it doesn't work here. Because of obviously, these properties are correlated. They're correlated. It's not really probabilistic correlated because we're working here with generalized convex structures. Right? Like what GPT people think that characterize quantum mechanics. If you move away from, but I mean, we are moving away from simplicius to here too. And we get this sort of entanglement too. I mean, so that's why I'm saying I don't like to call things classical because this, I mean, this is something we do in our head, you know? It's something, I mean, so basically, this is a banana. Of course, if you got a green banana or a bitter banana or a hard banana, they're all the same thing. They're all the same thing. And you represent them like by this green term or a yellow banana or a sweet banana or a soft banana, they're kind of the same thing. They're all the same thing, yeah?
Of course, these are correlations, but why aren't they classical correlations?
You could perfectly call them classical correlations, but this is, I mean, these structures, these convex structures are not simplicius. So if you follow the philosophy of GPT people, they say the moment you go away from a simplex, you get a quantum structure. That's not my voice, huh? That's not my voice. I'm just repeating the voice of people in the audience. Where is John? Hey, John. I totally okay. I'm the last person who will call this quantum. There's nothing quantum about this. It's just that we use exactly the same structures to reason about this thing. That's all. It's some logic, some interaction logic. And there's a very strong analogy going on here. Like another thing which I didn't emphasize this enough because you were all laughing, but I mean, using density matrices here is a totally natural thing. If you use vectors to represent meanings, and then when you got ambiguity of meaning, what do? You just do what Von Neumann did. You introduce mixed states. It's totally natural thing. You don't have to go quantum. You don't have to think quantum for that or anything. Like you can, and then we compute with these things. So the maps in our category are then CP maps. They're not just linear maps, they are your usual CP maps. So you work with the category of mixed states and CP maps to reason about these meanings. Is it quantum? I don't think so. There's nothing quantum about it, but we use exactly the same stuff.
A way of phrasing Adrian's question was keeping to the convex sets we're using might be to do with whether they're separable or entangled in the GPT sense.
I don't know. Good question. It's a good question. The question is it a good question? Like, would it make a difference? Possibly it would. I don't know. Depends on the answer, I guess. There are these papers out there which says, okay, language is non-local because they start to verify Bell inequalities about correlations in language. I mean, of course, language is non-local. These things interact with each other. At least words are not separate things. And then it's not just non-local, they signal. Different words signal to each other. I mean, it's bloody obvious, otherwise they can't interact. So one has to be a bit careful with these questions that one doesn't make oneself look, I don't know, by actually putting too much effort in it. You understand what I mean? So I don't know the answer. This is just a practical problem which we are trying to solve here, and we end up using it the same material, same machinery as a lot of other people. I think that's right. So now my picture's upside down. Doesn't matter. The way you build something like a yellow banana is
you got your word banana.
Then you got your word yellow, which we actually give some sort of internal structure. It doesn't really matter. It's because there's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Like, if, for example, if you say blue as a color, and you attribute it to something, it doesn't really work as a proposition all the time. When you say blue meat, it doesn't mean you got a blue steak. It's not blue. It's sort of slightly purplish. So colors aren't always propositional. So here I do a simplification using this dot, which is sort of this copy dot. It makes things propositional because I say I've got a banana, and I compose it now with the meaning of yellow. And then you see, you have to think of this as a conjunction. So I say something is yellow and something is a banana, and then you get a yellow banana. So that's how propositional reasoning works in these pictures. Slightly more complicated example is like fruit which tastes bitter. I mean, it's again something you can compute using, so you build this structure, you build your category, and then you ask, and you stick it in a machine, and then you ask the machine the question, what is a fruit which tastes bitter? And then the machine is going to tell you, well, it's both fruit and it tastes bitter, so it's a green banana. I mean, these are things you compute. I mean, I'm not computing them here, but these are things you compute by hand or compute by machine. So you now can reason compositionally about these concepts, and this goes a little bit beyond language. This goes a lot beyond language. Okay, so he was very happy. That's good. He actually understood what we wrote, so that's good. Steingraf. There's a lot of more stuff to be done, and this can actually be connected to whether you get actually genuine entanglement or separation or something like that. I don't know. But grammar itself is ambiguous. So grammar itself is ambiguous, so you actually have to start making mixed states of these grammatical diagrams to encode your ambiguity. Again, it's a natural thing to do. It's what von Neumann did for states. It's a natural thing to do. And then grammar and meaning are not separate, neither. Like, I had this picture, grammar, meaning, they're actually much more intertwined because, for example, in English, you would say large red, or what would you say, large red or red large car? Large red car or red large car? You're English. What would you say? Large red. There's only one thing you say, and actually, there are seven kinds of adjectives you turn out, and you always put them in a specific order. And this is about meaning. This is not just about grammatical structure. So there's some structure in your sentence which is directly related to meaning. I mean, these are things you can all do. So it's sort of meh. And then another thing is like some of the sort of logical words like prepositions, like the stick is on the table, this all has immediately already a space-like connotation. It's really happening in 3D. You can only understand on, next. All these prepositions, they all have meanings embedded in 3D space. So So that's again somewhere where you already want, that there's some intertwining between meaning and this functional logical word in the sense of structure. So there's a lot more to be done here. Okay, now for the last bit of crazy philosophy. If you think about a sentence, lion hunts prey. That's a transitive verb. A lion totally understands its grammatical structure. Totally. Because he understands very well that there is an action of hunting, that the lion is the hunter, and that the prey is the prey, and not the other way around. I mean, a lion doesn't sort of show himself to like some deer and then eat me. He doesn't do that. And this is because the lion understands the grammatical structure here. So grammatical structure. So what do I mean by grammatical structure? By grammatical structure, I mean that the meaning of what does this grammatical structure does? It's sort of an action which takes place in the real world, like an hunting process, which is a very basic action, which is probably the first basic action which ever happened on the world by something which was like a life form, and it involves the thing which wants to eat and the things which will be eaten. And that's object-subject verb. That structure is just like the action of two things in the real world. And it's a very primitive thing. So I mean, with this idea, and that's why this sort of grammatical structure works perfectly for cognition or forever or anything else. Like one thing I'm working on now, especially if somebody tells me a sentence, like the flower pot is on the table, I mean, do you see a flower pot on the table when I said it? Maybe not everybody, but some people must have immediately imagined flower pot on the table, right? You do that. So what's happening in your head? How does the grammatical structure of the flower pot being on the table translate in whatever you do in your head visually? Because this sort of what people call grammatical structure actually also like also structures the way we think about images. We really literally have a flower pot, we have a table, and we put the flower pot on the table. Cowboy shoots Indian. You got a cowboy, you got an Indian, cowboy shoots. You probably give him a gun and probably the Indian is with his back to the cowboy because cowboy shoot Indian in the back all the time. So ultimately, like something we have now, or almost, is that we got some functor really from grammatical structure to images. So you can actually translate anything sentence you say into a video, so to say. I mean, Google can translate a word in an image. We all know that, right? So the problem here is how do you translate a composite sentence in an image, and you use exactly the compositional structure which I've been giving you to do that. You put like the two actors, the object and the subject, in the picture, and then there is an action between them, which is typically an extra feature, which can be a relative position or something like that, and it actually defines your data to make the movie. And you can compose these things, and you can make an entire movie clip coming out of language. So that's sort of where it becomes cool, that by having these common structures to say language, cognition, or movies. But I mean, these movies are cognition. That's literally when I told you the flower pot is on the table, that's what you were doing. You translated one way or another this idea of flower pot being on the table into some mental image. And this can be a movie if it's dynamic, like somebody is trying chasing somebody else. So that's dynamic in time. So that's what we do when we talk to. Now, movie clips to language, that's for me the origin of grammar. Like because people were imagining these movies, and then suddenly they had to translate this into words and sentences to communicate, and that's where actually the grammatical structure came out. So it's not at all something which was hardwired in our head, I think. It's not at all something like that. I'm done. I mean, I keep time, always. So what did we do? We started with quantum physics. We turned it into diagrams. Then we recognized these diagrams were available in language already as grammatical structure. And then we just like push this further into cognition, be it like visual cognition or like the way we perceive our sentences. And so why is there this connection? I mean, it's not because it's all quantum, not at all. Like that's the biggest disclaimer I'm going to make here. I'm not claiming that there is anything quantum about it. Maybe what is useful is thinking that stuff which we call quantum is maybe less weird than we think and is a lot more present around us and inside of us, in our brain. All these structures are already going on. And then the subtlety is like, what is really quantum? And that's what your question was about. What do we really call quantum? I mean, can we talk about quantum without reference to physical space? Because, for example, for non-locality, you need to make reference to a physical space where you live. But definitely a lot of the sort of compositional structure we see here is already anywhere, is everywhere else. And it was probably the first thing which was there ever in our understanding. Okay, I mean, yeah, some more crackpot references. Yeah, okay.
So in the example, She Who Hates Bob, which was in the very beginning, to explain the meaning, you had this state for hate, which was some prior information?
So the way people get these vectors in general is, I mean, the most standard way, like is, if you start with a huge vector space, like maybe a million dimensions, and the basis vectors are words, which you use as reference words. It's sort of like a reference frame. And then you go to a big piece of text and you look how many times the word you want to assign meaning to appears in the context of one of the other words. You start counting, and this gives you sort of coordinates. And it turns out that this sort of vector is a very good representation of the meaning of a word. And like the thing, for example, if you got two synonyms, then you would expect them to be interchangeably arising in the same context all the time. So they would get the same vectors. And if you then compute the inner product, then the inner product is a witness of how similar they are. And so, okay, so people typically do this with words like nouns. But people used to do exactly the same thing for verbs too. Now, what you see here, and that was sort of practically a big change for us, a verb. So in Google would think of a verb as having a single Y. So it lives in the same space as the nouns and all that. They just live all in one bag. So we make things a bit more complicated because for us a verb is a composite type. So we had to come up with a new way to engineer the verbs. And then one typical way would be what I was sort of doing with the hates. Like you try to look in your big corpus whether you find any evidence of something hating something, and then you build this big sum of all the things which hate everything. That's one way to do it. That's one way to do it.
So would you interpret that like as memory or like meaning from earlier sentences?
Oh, memory, that's a totally different beast because like then you go into the land of anaphora. Sometimes you say you have two sentences like my brother blah blah blah, and then in the next sentence you say he. So that makes reference to a previous sentence, and that's something we're actually now working on to actually get this sort of interaction, which is a memory. And sometimes to understand the sentence, you actually need a bigger content. So another thing we have is like a thermal bed, like in thermodynamics, a big thermal bed, which is pretty much like all you know already, and to which extent. Now we're trying to now come up with a model that actually informs the meaning of a sentence, because a lot of sentences just don't. I mean, when I say something, I may say here. I mean, it's important for you to know where here is, and the fact that we're both here, and then you know that we're talking about this room. So there is a lot of extra stuff going on, like this big thermal bed, memory from the past. But I mean, this is pretty clear statement, which doesn't really ask for a lot of context, but most sentences do. You're totally right.
How would you distinguish, just a question, between knowing whether the meaning was hates or loves? It's just a list of pairs.
Very good. Like this vector space model of meaning is really bad, for exactly the reason you just say, and it tends to give opposites the same meaning, which is really bad. And when you do a Google search, you know this, you get typically also the opposite for what you're searching for. And that's a problem with the way meanings are. There's a lot of bad things about vector spaces. Like for example, a vector space is a very flat structure. You want to say like, a lion is an example of a big cat is an example of a mammal is blah, 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 a vertebrate and stuff like that. This is like an order structure, that you got an inclusion structure of like more and less information. The vector space doesn't do that. Density matrices actually allow you to do that. That's another reason we use density matrices, to have sort of this entailment structure. So these vector spaces, I'm just saying it, but they're extremely bad models of meaning. Extremely bad. Especially like there is no not operation in linear algebra. You only have two-dimensional, really a good notion of an odd gate. Higher dimension doesn't exist. So we don't have meaning for the word not in the vector space model, which is pretty bad.
Yeah. Apart from belt type experiment, which I don't think this is a very big part of our experimental evidence, we can imagine some modified classical theory which explain every well everything which we see around.
Uh-huh.
So if this would be our world, then you can simplify significantly your formalism, or even your formalism will be wrong, or what is the difference with classical world, really, and this, even the pictures, it still looks somewhat sophisticated, let's say.
Are you talking about...
Can you simplify it significantly? How much it will be simplified when we have no reason to believe in quantum effects?
Like I say, like the general gist of the formalism is not really that specifically quantum, it's for compositional structure. It's just that historically we have this misconception that classical concepts are Cartesian, that you describe the whole by describing the parts. Turns out, like for most examples I'm talking about, like language and concepts, it's not the case. Now, is this really quantum? Because the models which I'm introducing, I'm just making this case, like the quantum model, which is the linear algebra model, is actually a very bad model for a lot of these things. The people in natural language processing, they use it, but it's really bad. Like for the example that Lucian showed, like typically, you have no notion of not in linear algebra. You don't have it. So the quantum model is actually a bad model, and we are looking for better ones. Would this represent like reality better if we forget about non-locality? Possibly. I mean, we're just looking for... So one thing we use, this is maybe an interesting example, something John knows about and was interested in too, is like what did Van Neumann do? Like he started with vectors and then he made density matrix or some sort of doubling procedure. Now you can do the same again. You can take density matrix and double them again and you get a new theory, which is not quantum mechanics, it's something more sophisticated. And we actually use it because we both wanted to encode ambiguity and this idea of entailment in one structure. So probably you want to go beyond quantum mechanics because meaning is much... Here is a simple thing. If you have a theory of meaning, it should include the theory about physical meaning. So physics should be part of it, right? It should in principle. Whatever it is, should be part of it because meaning encompasses everything. So you expect a much more sophisticated structure here than your theory of physics. You expect that.
Could you prove perhaps that quantum
because we have a question right back there, which is Ravi.
I was just wondering to what extent was the work sort of contingent on using English as your example, or
that's a very beautiful thing, and that actually also shows that these diagrams are right. So this is the structure of a transitive verb in English. So now in other languages, the object and the subject may change places. And sometimes you got both on the left and both on the right. And for all possible permutations of object, subject, and verb, there is a language where you do it. So this means that this order is totally arbitrary. There's nothing deep about it. It's something which happened in certain places. Now, what is the same is the wiring stuff. The topology of the wires is always the same. But they may sort of shift around. And sort of a nice, there's a paper by Marnoush Adrazadeh where she looks at different language groups. And for example, like English and French have sort of the same wire structure. Hebrew and Arab have the same wire structure. So there's different groups of languages which have exactly the same wire structure. And depending on the culture, like things only communicate between words very close to each other. While for example, in Persian, like the meanings jump from one side of the sentence to the other all the time. So these diagrams, but the topology is the same. So clearly there's something cultural about the way people order words in their personal language. But all this stuff works for any language.
If you were given some corpus of text from some arbitrary language, let's say some finite size, it's not like an infinite corpus, then you don't know what the language, let's say you're trying to decipher a language or something.
Okay.
Do you think this might have an application there? Could you say that this set of symbols means something in terms of words and sentences? I don't know if it has any direct connection to that.
I mean, what you're talking is almost like a decoding problem, figuring out which language it is. I mean, people do this because if you type in a sentence and translate in some weird language, Google will figure out what it is. And it will translate it to English. Now, why do people use English? Because that's the biggest corpus of text. Like size is really important here. The size of your corpus to do anything useful.
Okay.
So that's why you use English. You're not going to use some marginal language which doesn't have much publicly available text. That's it, but otherwise it's just words. I mean, the Chinese are obviously doing this for Chinese, all this stuff, because they have enough text too, so.
Okay, let's thank Bob.